Women's Wellness.
I'm going to call to order the House Committee on Healthcare.
And I'm going to open up an informational hearing on two House bills, House Bill 2523 and House Bill 2648. Shall I talk about the bill?
And I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 2523 and House Bill 2648. And I'm happy to call the first witness, my fellow chair.
Thank you.
Sandy?
Right here. Thank you.
Good morning, esteemed colleagues. For the record, I am State Representative Carolyn Tomei from House District 41, and I represent the folks in the city of Milwaukee and part of the Southeast Portland area. Colleagues, I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 2523 and House Bill 2648, two bills that deal with pharma gifting, which is a marketing practice of pharmaceutical companies. Consumers are acutely aware of the pharmaceutical industry's effort to market prescription drugs directly to patients. How many times do you hear a TV advertisement that starts, ask your doctor about whether it's Ambien, Lunesta, Viagra? What is not so obvious to the public is that the marketing directed at our doctors, the pharmaceutical industry spends about 90% of its $21 billion marketing budget on gifts and promotions for healthcare professionals, five times more than they spend on TV ads aimed at consumers. And we see those TV ads every day, and we see the print ads in our newspapers take up whole pages. We see them in our magazines, including pages and pages of Reader's Digest. House Bill 2523 is a disclosure bill. It would require pharmaceutical companies to submit an annual report to the Oregon Department of Justice, disclosing all gifts and payments to physicians, hospitals, pharmacists, and other healthcare professionals. The bill does not include drug samples intended for patients or gifts valued at $25 or less. House Bill 2648 would actually prohibit gifts and incentives valued at over $25, and it also does not apply to free samples intended for patient use. And I'm going to keep on emphasizing that this is not intended for samples intended for patient use, neither of these bills. Direct marketing to medical professionals contributes to the rising cost of prescription drugs in two ways. First, the huge marketing campaign aimed at doctors and other healthcare professionals increases the pharmaceutical's cost of producing the drug. And second, this marketing directly encourages doctors to prescribe new drugs, which are more costly, as opposed to better established, less expensive alternatives. This costs both patients and insurance providers more. Moreover, consumers have no way to track the influence that drug manufacturers bring to bear on healthcare professionals, and hopefully we'll hear from the healthcare professionals today on what kind of influence they do feel. As an elected official, when I accept a campaign donation, I must disclose who contributes that money or the gift and the amount. Patients should be able to obtain the same kind of information about their healthcare professionals and the drug companies. Colleagues, this intense marketing effort benefits only the pharmaceutical industry. Doctors already have independent, reliable resources to learn about the efficacy of medications. Patients need to be able to trust that their doctors and other healthcare professionals have not been unduly influenced by the strong promotional efforts of the pharmaceutical industry. House Bill 2523 and House Bill 2648 each address this problem. 2648 would actually prohibit such gifts and incentives, whereas 2523 requires only disclosure. so that patients and physicians can track the efforts of the drug industry to influence doctors' prescribing efforts and patterns. The United States has the highest drug costs in the world, and drug prices are increasing rapidly. Colleagues, whether we choose the disclosure avenue or the outright prohibition, with the skyrocketing costs of prescription medications, we must give patients and healthcare providers the tools that they need to help hold down these costs. I urge you to consider House Bill 2523 and House Bill 2648 and move a pharma gifting bill to the House floor with a due pass recommendation. Thank you, and of course, I am open to questions, but I think there will be other people following me, including co-sponsor Representative Greenlick, who can probably better answer a lot of these questions, but I'll try if you want any to ask me any questions.
Thank you, Representative. Sandy, can I ask a question? Where are you?
Representative Andy Smith will answer your question.
No, Sandy?
We can have her down in a second.
Oh, she's not here?
She just stepped out for a moment.
Let me ask you a question. We'll be fine. Will this testimony be in the records of both committees?
Yes, it will.
Okay, great. So all the testimony we get today will be in the record of both committees as we hear the bill. Thank you.
Representative Maurer, I think, had a question.
Did you? No, I thought you did.
I did.
Go ahead.
Okay.
No,
thank you, Mr. Chair. Question. What?
Thank you, Representative.
You didn't see him waiting.
What was the impetus for this bill? I would like to ask the esteemed chair also, but what was your interest in introducing this bill, and when did that occur?
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Maurer. Thank you for that question. As you probably know, I've been on the Health and Human Services Committee for 3 terms, and every term we would hear more and more about the rising cost of health care, and we tried more and more with fewer and fewer dollars to meet those health care needs to the citizens of Oregon. And as I was studying these issues, I became more and more aware of the high cost of pharmaceuticals. At the same time, I was looking at these ads and reading articles about the high cost of pharmaceuticals. And as I started doing research, I became aware of the high, it was really obvious, the billions of dollars that it cost for advertising directly to the consumer. That was really obvious. As I started digging deeper, I became aware of how much more that the pharmaceutical industry was giving to healthcare professionals for promoting their drugs. So that started my interest in at least becoming aware, for me as a legislator and as a person on the Health and Human Services Committee, but also wanting to make the public aware of this so that the public can be knowledgeable when they are prescribed Vioxx or Viagra, there was another drug that was very expensive and we learned was very dangerous. The public needs to know if their physician or the person who's writing this prescription drug, they need to know, has this person been influenced perhaps by this drug company to urge me to buy this drug? So it was just disclosure and becoming aware also as a legislator that whatever gift or inducement I've been given to influence me in the legislature, I have to disclose that. And boy, I really like that. I think that we should. That's transparency to me. And I think the medical profession also needs to be transparent, that we need to know how our medical professionals are being influenced. Is that too long an answer to a very simple question?
Thank you. A follow-up, please?
Please.
And I just need to disclose that I probably have a conflict of interest in this issue, and that's just for the record. One question. You cite two facts.
What's your conflict, please?
My conflict is that my wife and I own a small medical practice in Rogue River, Oregon. Two questions about some facts. You cite 90% of the $21 billion annual marketing budget, et cetera, And where did you get that figure would be one question. And the same thing is the United States has the highest drug costs in the world, and where did you get that? Because I can bring FDA white papers suggesting that our generics are, in fact, some of the cheapest in the world.
So. I agree with that. And I did bring a couple of books with me, and I can also get back to you with the answers to that, Representative.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Mayor.
Representative Olson.
Madam Chair, I maintain respectability here.
It's a lost cause.
I'm scared of the
push-ups.
Are you aware or do I appreciate your testimony and where you're wanting to go with this and everything. I'm just curious, are there some pharmaceutical companies out there right now that are trying to develop policies to address this issue? And I mean, are you familiar with those? Because I've heard that there might be some out there.
Chair Green, like Representative Olson, yes, thank you for that question. And yes, I am aware of that.
Okay. There,
the answer is yes.
Thank you. So are they in line with where you're wanting to go right now with this, your concept here, or can you expound on that for us?
Chair Green, like, I think so. But what I'm hearing is information without facts included in that. I've been told that that's happening. I guess what I'm after is transparency. I want to make sure that's happening.
Okay.
I think we'll have some testimony on that. And
okay.
I think we'll have the people before us who can answer that question.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair Greenlee.
Mr. Chair, when are you testifying?
I was going to make some opening comments, and I will make a couple of open comments rather than formal testimony, and I'd be happy to answer your question. In the session's beginning in 2001, it's been very clear that there is a problem with costs in our healthcare system, and it's been reflecting on us in terms of things we have to deal with in the terms of the price of health insurance and in the in our ability to manage a Medicaid population. The pharmacy area is one area of cost we've had to deal with. It represents, I think we'll have somebody who can testify better. I haven't seen the data lately, but maybe 20% of the total cost of the healthcare dollar. And in some of the years, in the era around, for example, the 2001-2003, it was the fastest growing component of the healthcare system, even though not a majority of the healthcare dollars. We've been dealing with this problem in a variety of ways, trying to keep the Oregon Health Plan in place, dealing with the Bulk Purchasing Act, dealing with some things about hospital costs, and we'll be dealing more in that area around transparency of hospital costs. And from the beginning of these discussions that I've been following very closely, and actually I've been following since 1987, but I've been following very closely in the 21st century, it's clear that pharmacy costs are a piece of the problem. What's not clear is how to deal with it, because we all recognize that the drugs we use in American society, in the American medical care system, are very powerful and important drugs. And my guess is each of us here has either a personal experience or a family experience with members of the family that have been extraordinarily aided because of the modern pharmaceuticals that are available now that weren't available, say, 20 years ago. And nothing in these bills are intended to denigrate the importance that the pharmaceutical industry has had to the healthcare system of the United States. The problem is, how do we work toward creating a proper pattern of the use of drugs across a population? And it's clear in the literature, as you read the literature over the past 50 years, as I have. I started as a professor of pharmacy administration in the mid-50s, so it's a field I've been looking at for a long time. The way doctors get information on the proper drugs to prescribe for their patients is a very complex matter. It's what happened in medical school when they first went to medical school. It's in their interaction with the pharmacy detail people who come and talk to them very directly. It's in the meetings they go to and in the lectures that they hear in their continuing education. And it's very much involved in their interaction with their patients who get information in a variety of ways. Many of us have felt over time that we need to move the system so that we have the most rational possibility of physicians having the information they need to make decisions that are the appropriate decisions in terms of both the efficiency and the effectiveness of their therapy. And one of the distortions in that, although we're not sure there's a model that tells exactly how this happened, but it's clear one of the things that distorts that system is the relationship between the physicians and the direct representatives they have from the pharmaceutical company. What we hope is to create a system where that information flow is a clear and pure and fair information flow and not distorted by a variety of things, including gifts that have become the habit of some drug representatives in terms of their relationships with their patient. We have two approaches in front of us. They've come out of a review of what's been going on around the country, and there have been two approaches that have been proposed. One is the reporting approach. The other has been tried only in one state, I think, and hasn't been implemented, and that's the question of the direct ban. In answer to Representative Maurer's question, and I hope we'll have some testimony on this, it is clear that some of the drug companies, as a part of their relationship with the federal government, have been creating policies around gifts that they can or cannot give to directly to patients. And the hope was that at least if we choose in our committee work after hearing testimony a relatively total gift ban, that we can make that in a way that it's most consistent with the policies that are emerging already, as I understand from direct contact, from at least some, if not all, of the drug companies, and we will hear more about that. So with that, I suggest we move forward. I'll ask the witnesses. Three of the key witnesses are here to testify on both bills. Rather than separating that testimony, if that's an okay thing to do, I'll ask you to testify on both bills simultaneously, unless it's your preference not to do it that way. And I'll leave it up to the witnesses, and we have room for more witnesses if there are others that haven't had a chance to sign up yet. Let me start first by calling...
Are you going to take any questions?
Okay, yes, I'm happy to.
Who?
Mr. Representative Maurer, yes.
Yes, this is...
thank you, Mr. Vice Chair.
Mr. Chair, I mean, this. I have an interest in this, and because I'm at the receiving end, and I'm going to make a comment here that in the last 5 years, it's night and day.
How about testifying? I would be delighted. Would you be willing to testify?
I would be very willing to testify.
It would be great to have a provider testifying.
Well, I'm not a provider. I'm an administrator of a clinic who sees my wife who provides. But
no, if you'd like to, it would be great if you would testify.
It's very short.
Sure.
Please do.
If you can keep it under control.
It's hard.
I know, it's very difficult.
Chairs, members of the committee, I'm Representative Ron Maurer, and I come to you today as the co-owner, and my wife does all the work. I just take some of the glory of a small Medicare certified rural health clinic in the town of Rogue River, Oregon. Our mission is to serve people that primarily cannot receive care in other locations because we are in a, quote, rural area as defined by the federal government. In the last 5 years, it's obvious that the drug industry because we get these folks, representatives in there on a daily basis. We get them there, you know, hawking their ware. And that the industry has changed. And it's, they come and commiserate with us and say how onerous the system is that they have to abide by from their company. And I can't speak to a specific company because they're all a little different. But the reality is that the things that are availed to us today are on a magnitude of 10 or 100 or something less than they were 5 years ago. And that the industry, in my opinion, does take this very seriously. And it's we court these people because we want them to provide us with free samples. Because those free samples are used to provide, are given to people that otherwise cannot afford them. And in our circumstance, these pharmaceuticals are very needed. And I know that's not part of the bill, but that's also part of the marketing effort. And so I just want to let you know from that provider side that it's not, I've never been offered a trip to Maui. I've never been offered an outing, a golf outing in Southern Oregon, a fishing outing. The most that we have been offered are meals, with maybe one exception. There was a counseling get together with a number of providers that my wife went to some years ago in Ashland. But otherwise, it's a meal. And it's a drug informational meeting, and usually these providers that are testifying, or not testifying, excuse me, but presenting, are quote, not affiliated with the pharmaceutical companies. I've seen the director of the Stanford Cardiology Clinic. I've been educated by that gentleman. I've had people from OHSU. We've had it from the Midwest. And so I just want you to make sure that you're looking at where we are at today and not where we were 5 years ago. And that would be my emphasis. And I will take any questions.
Yes. Yes, Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Madam Chair. Representative Maurer, when you talked about the pharmaceutical information that you might receive when you're enjoying dinner, is that in the nature of what, photograph copies or a book or a booklet or a binder? Can you give us what I'm trying to get to is the retail value of something like that.
Right. Chairs, Representative Flores, the answer would be the most value would be in the meal that you're at. What you get is maybe a handout, a flyer, and usually a PowerPoint presentation, and I don't know how you can value, you can't take it, but it's the PowerPoint presentation, which is probably more than half. And really, the number of those meals today is minimal compared to what it used to be, just in the last 3 or 4 years.
I sell all my PowerPoint presentations on the street, and I've gotten up, I've gotten up to 15 cents for one of them. So. Are you done, Representative Flores?
Representative Gillian.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Mr. Chair. Representative Maurer, I I wanted to ask you, do you benefit from what I understand to be sort of the two-tiered, you kind of alluded to it, but one free sample program is exactly that. It's samples that you can then, if you choose to, pass on to potential patients. And the other is actually requesting, I don't know if they're excess, but requesting drugs for those who could not otherwise pay.
Yeah, Chairs and Representative Gilliam, and the answer to that, and you have to remember the context. I'm not a provider. I'm a business manager, and I don't see from the specialist side, whether you're a cardiologist, whether you're a dermatologist. I don't know how that area works, but I do know the primary care. And the answer to your question is that we get free samples that the provider determines how they're going to be distributed, and the pharmaceutical companies gives us no guidelines other than what's on the labeling as to how to distribute that. And it's given as a prescription, but rather than go to your local pharmacist, we hand you the samples, And we do that very judiciously with its very intent on who we give this to. We're not giving it to the state employee that has PEP because they got a good benefit, but we do give it to people that aren't covered, are uninsured or underinsured. The other piece of that program is where we go and we assist the patient in going to a pharmaceutical company by name and say, we want to participate in one of your programs so that this specific patient can receive a specific drug for a specific condition. And the pharmaceutical company has a fund, and everyone's a little different. I'm sure they'll testify to it. But these are by name, and I would not want these programs to be rolled into that as a marketing, and we probably have to have some specific language of that. And so there are two ways that we do go about it.
Neither of those are included in either of the bills.
Okay.
I'm going to ask a question if I may, Mr. Chair. So, in your experience, when a patient is given free samples of a prescription, and usually I would assume it would be one of the newer prescriptions, am I assuming correctly?
For the most part, yes, ma'am.
Okay. So, in your experience, then does the patient follow up with that same prescription, or do they generally fall back on maybe a generic or less experienced?
Madam Chair, I cannot truthfully answer that question.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you.
Very much appreciate that. Mm-hmm. Some of you may have noticed me shutting off my cell phone. I wish you'd all follow my modeling because cell phones, even on silence, screw up our recording system. All right. The only...
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry. Can I ask myself a question?
Please make it so you can understand what you're talking about.
No, Mr. Chair, I do have one question. And this has, the bill is about, and this is to you, and it is about, this is about pharmaceuticals. And there are many other providers out there, not providers, suppliers out there that provide stuff. And I'm wondering, I'm curious, and examples, and I went to the Office of the Inspector General and looked at their list. You've got clinical laboratories, you've got home health agencies, third-party medical billing companies, durable medical equipment, prosthetics, orthotics, and other various supply industry people. Why is this not just a blanket instead of just pharmaceuticals? Because a lot of these are very expensive pieces of equipment, and I don't see it in my clinic, but in other cases.
I think you're wearing a couple of those.
I am. I'm wearing orthotics, it turns out, at $900 per leg. But, I think when we begin to take action on these bills, if you'd like to prepare an amendment to have that effect, I think that would be perfectly appropriate. We can debate that question, because you're absolutely right. The big-ticket items are... I mean, the big ticket seeing the individual items is selling somebody an MRI, for example. I mean, there are some other industry things that are very big tickets. The whole question of embedded devices is another very important issue.
And I ask that, but I would like the industry to come back, because I'm assuming I'm probably taking a position that may not be very popular with those folks. But the reality is that at campaign contribution, we don't distinguish between... various sectors. It's all contributions, and it's all. So I just bring that.
Let's keep that on the agenda so we can talk about it. Lorraine Heller is here to testify on one of the bills. The other three we have signed up are here to testify on both the bills. So, Lorraine, perhaps you can give us some information from the DHS perspective.
Good morning, Chair Greenleg.
Nice to see you again.
Nice to see you again, Chair Tomei and representatives. I'm here to test. My name is Lorraine Duncan. I'm the Immunization Program Manager for the Oregon Public Health Division, Department of Human Services. And I'm here to share a couple of concerns about House Bill 2648. The first one I'd like to share with you is that according to the way the bill is currently written, the Oregon Public Health Division would be considered a vaccine manufacturer. And The second one is that the Oregon Public Health Division currently receives educational grants, occasionally small grants from vaccine manufacturers, and we'd like to continue to do that and provide a little bit more information about how that works. Starting with the definition currently reads that an entity that repackages or distributes prescription drugs would be considered a pharmaceutical manufacturer. The Public Health Division currently distributes about $20 million worth of vaccine annually. And we have other programs like STD, HIV, tuberculosis programs that distribute antibiotics to public and private providers. So we would like to be excluded from the definition of a vaccine manufacturer. The types of grants we receive are often small, maybe one grant a year or two grants a year that range from like $500 to a couple thousand dollars a year. Therefore, like bringing a speaker that's not associated with a pharmaceutical manufacturer to talk about a particular vaccine to either providers or consumers, or for us to do a brochure about a particular vaccine. What I'd like to explain is something that we feel makes us not biased in regard to vaccines. The Center for Disease Control allows every state, when they're distributing vaccines like we do, to either decide to provide all the different brands that are available and let the providers, like the doctor or the nurse, decide what brand they want, or you can pick the brand that you want, and that's everybody in your state has to order that. So in Oregon, many years ago, we chose to be what we call a choice state, which means that when we provide our vaccines to public and private providers, we offer all the brands. So the order form that we give to the providers has all the brands available, and the providers then pick which brand they want, and we provide that specific brand that they like. So we are interested in exemption for these entities when applying for educational funding using established bona fide policies and procedures designed to prevent conflict of interest or anti-competition, promotion of a particular brand over another. So we want to make sure that our program never advertises a particular company. We talk about hepatitis A vaccine or hepatitis B vaccine. We don't talk about the different manufacturers. We do make all brands available. Our coalitions, the Adult Immunization Coalition and the Oregon Partnership to Immunize Children, have received small grants over many years. And I looked exactly how much we have received in the last year, and it was about $7,000. So if the bill moves forward, we request that the state and local health departments be excluded from the definition of pharmaceutical manufacturer and added as a potential recipient of educational grants. Appreciate the opportunity to testify, and I'd be happy to answer any of your questions.
Great. Thank you so much. Any questions?
I have a question.
Hey.
Do you advertise to the public?
Chair Greenlatt, we do media campaigns sometimes around, like, the one we're doing right now is for fourth diphtheria tetanus acellular pertussis vaccine that's on a regular. So we do that regularly.
And I assume you also send people out to talk to doctors about how to use the products you distribute as well, is that right?
That's exactly true.
You give any gifts?
I was telling Phoebe this.
Phoebe doesn't count.
Yeah, no. You know, we can't provide any special thanks to our providers, and some of them work so hard for us. And so every year we have this is minor, but I have to tell you this. So every year we have this immunization conference, and our staff donate and make these theme baskets, and our staff all the materials in there. And sometimes they're $100, and we usually do five or six of them. I said, gosh, I wonder if that would not allow us to do our baskets anymore. So that's the only gifts we give. And occasionally, I mean, in the past, I think we've given, like, a cup that said the Vaccine for Children program, or a pen that said the Vaccine for Children program, maybe a little, and I think we did little canvas bags.
Can I ask another question?
Oh, please do.
If you're included under And you're testifying on 2648, the gift ban. Let's say you were included as a manufacturer. What would the consequences be?
Well, it wouldn't allow us to do our baskets, for one thing. And it wouldn't, the way it's currently written, we wouldn't be able to get our educational grants from the vaccine manufacturers. Because it limits them now. The way the bill's worded, it talks about scholarships, but it doesn't talk about the educational grants for speakers or for consumer information materials.
There's something here that says manufacturers cannot receive gifts? You're saying if you're named as a manufacturer, you would not be able to receive a gift?
Well, I think the way the Chair Greenlee, the way the bill is worded, it explains that the type of grants that you'd be able to receive, and I think that was limited to special stipends. It didn't seem to go into the type of educational grants that we got.
This isn't. Do you see something in this bill that says pharmaceutical manufacturers may not receive gifts?
No.
Okay, so you're talking about it would inhibit you from receiving a gift?
Right. So the way the bill is written, it indicates that that pharmaceutical companies could only give special grants in circumstances like special education, scholarships, that sort of thing. It didn't mention the types of educational grants that we give.
Lorraine, you're confusing me here now. Let's see if I can get
let me
finish.
Okay, sorry.
You're saying that you are afraid you will be identified as a manufacturer, and that's what worries you. Now, if you have been identified as a manufacturer, you would say because you've been identified as a manufacturer, you cannot receive a gift?
Chair Greenlee, it's two separate issues. So,
okay.
So one is in regard to the definition of the pharmaceutical manufacturer, and the second one is the type of grants, even if when we're not included in that definition, that we would be allowed to receive. So they're two separate issues. I'm sorry I didn't make that clear.
Because you're either a physician or a person authorized to prescribe prescription drugs?
No, and maybe I'm wrong. My understanding was that it defines what kind of grants that the pharmaceutical company could give to anybody.
Can give to a physician or other persons authorized to prescribe prescription drugs.
Right. So if we were excluded from the definition, then we wouldn't have a problem.
Representative Kotek, you?
I was going to suggest that it is two different issues, that you could be impacted if the pharmaceutical companies can't give anyone gifts that you're impacted, but I guess that's not totally correct.
That's not what the bill says.
She's talking about giving a scholarship.
Right. If pharma wants to give the vaccine program some grants, but they're not allowed to give grants to anyone, then you're impacted.
That's
right.
Is
that what you're
saying?
That's
perfect.
But that's, okay.
That's exactly what I'm saying.
But I don't know if that's clear.
You think you might not be able to give out the receipts of those scholarships? Is that what's... Well, anyway. Thank you. We will take this under advisement.
Mr. Chair.
Sure.
Okay.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you. Just before Ms. Duncan leaves the table, she mentioned the $100 gift baskets that they give to their participants in their educational events, if I'm not misunderstanding. And I think maybe where some of the wires got crossed was in regard to grants and gifts. And you're because you would be identified as a repackager here, as a pharmaceutical manufacturing company, because you repackage or somehow redistribute,
right,
that they would be prohibited from providing those
Absolutely.
Gifts.
Yeah,
so
no, if they were a manufacturer, they'd have to only put $25 worth of things in the gift package rather than $100 worth. That is true.
Mr. Chair?
Sir? Ma'am?
I guess I would tend to not want to exclude because you're providing a vaccine to providers who in turn get reimbursed for this, or are they providing it for free?
Chairs and representatives, the vaccine that we receive is federal funds that come to us, and they are not they cannot charge for that vaccine.
Okay.
Any other questions at this point? Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We'll take that into advisement.
Okay, could I call up Jim Gardner and Tom Holt, please?
Are those worth $25?
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jim Gardner, appearing today for Pharma, and I want to begin by...
can you please describe what Pharma is?
Pharma is the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America. It's the National Trade Association that represents the vast majority of the brand name drug manufacturers. I want to begin by saying that over the years, and it is now many years, it has been a great privilege to participate with a number of members of this committee on this ongoing debate with regard to what Chair Greenlich, I think, characterized as a quest for transparency, for, these would be my terms, evidence-based approaches to the evaluation of prescription drugs, a part of Senate Bill 819, which we have strongly supported, and other steps that have been undertaken in both the public and the private sector to attempt to bring some degree of market-driven rationality to the healthcare delivery system, a quest which is ongoing in its nature, uncertain in its prospects, but presents a tremendous challenge, I think, for all of us, both in the public and the private sector. And as one of the leaders in that effort, Representative Greenlich, you've played an enormously important and valuable role, and for that, I think all of us are greatly appreciative. Let me begin by attempting to frame this issue in terms of what I would call a precautionary principle. That's a term that is often favored by the environmental community, and I think it's a good term. And I would suggest a legislative precautionary principle that perhaps might incorporate three elements. The first is a need before legislating to dispassionately analyze the nature and scope of the current problem, not simply the perception of that problem, but the nature and scope of the current problem. Second step might be to determine whether efficacious steps have been taken or are being taken elsewhere, either in the private sector or at the level of the federal government or conceivably elsewhere, but those in those two principal venues. And then finally, to determine whether the legislation which you are contemplating is both lawful and free of any unintended consequences that might overwhelm the good intentions that prompted it. With regard to the first element of my precautionary principle, the perceived problem, I don't think that a more eloquent and factual statement of what has happened in recent years could have been a more accurate or more dispassionate statement could have been provided than that you heard from Representative Maurer. That, I think, is an accurate reflection of the facts on the ground as they exist now. Today and 5 years ago are night and day. And I'm going to go into some of the reasons why I think that is the case. The second step is something being done elsewhere that addresses this issue effectively. And I would suggest to you that it is. The first is in the form of not only the Pharma Code, which is a voluntary code of conduct adopted by the association I represent, which addresses precisely the issues that have been about which concerns have been expressed by Chair Tomei and yourself, Chair Greenlich. It identifies the problem of inappropriate gifting and says that is not within our code of conduct. After the Pharma Code of Conduct was adopted, similar codes, but with greater detail, were promulgated, I believe, by every major pharmaceutical manufacturer. And much like the recently adopted legislative rules in the House with regard to gifting, these are voluntary steps, but they're highly efficacious steps. And I want to use that example because I would analogize those rules which go on a voluntary basis in terms of the body, putting tighter limits on than what the statute allows. Those are analogous to the voluntary codes that each of the manufacturers have adopted. Now, what has motivated the adoption of those voluntary codes? Well, I would like to think that it's entirely a matter of being public spirited, but I will tell you there was another huge factor that motivated them, and that was the promulgation of guidelines by the Office of Inspector General of the Department of Human Services. And while the penalty for an employee violating the voluntary guidelines of one of the manufacturers is quick and simple, you lose your job, the penalty for a company for violating the standards that have been promulgated by the OIG is equally draconian at the corporate level. And that penalty includes not only criminal sanctions, but loss of eligibility for participation in federally funded programs that pay for prescription drugs, principally Medicare, Medicaid, and the Veterans Program. So that is a very big stick. And the OIG guidelines go in great detail about their efforts to encourage the manufacturers to adopt these codes of conduct, which is a major reason, I believe, why, to my knowledge, all of them have done that. It's kind of like in the general business world having an antitrust compliance policy. It's good policy, but it's also something that's very much in the self-interest of the companies because they don't want to lose eligibility to participate in Medicaid and Medicare. So I would suggest to you that those two steps, the voluntary codes backed up by the very strong OIG sanction regime, has addressed this issue and is a major reason why the fact scenario that Representative Maurer laid out for you exists, why that change has occurred over the last 5 years. Now let me talk a little bit about legality, which is what I would say is one of the elements of the third element of this precautionary test. House Bill 2523, at least in the view of pharma's lawyers, pretty clearly violates 42 U.S. Code, Section 1396R8. That is the provision that makes confidential information that manufacturers are required to supply with regard to pricing and rebates for purposes of ensuring that they're in compliance with the best price mandate of Medicaid. And that law applies to states. If this bill were to require disclosure of that kind of data, again, which the pharma lawyers believe it can be read to do that, you'd be squarely in conflict with the federal statute, which would, of course, preempt. In addition, they believe that it could well infringe protected trade secrets, which include marketing strategies, rebate information, price information. And if that is the case, you could be facing a situation where the state, by attempting to enforce this law, could itself be potentially at risk for liability, as well as, of course, the cost of that litigation. Finally, the ban bill, House Bill 2648, in the view of Pharma Council, pretty clearly would reach into areas protected by Article 1, Section 8, which is the free speech clause of the Oregon Constitution. To give just one example, the dissemination of a reprint of a scientific paper with where you can establish the value from a single sale price by the publisher in excess of $25 would be covered by the bill, would be a gift, and would also constitute an exercise of rights protected by Article 1, Section 8.
Jim, excuse me.
Yeah.
Is that argument any gift would represent a free speech abridgment?
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, members of the committee, no. Material which contain a component of expression, as that term has been rather broadly construed by the Oregon Supreme Court, most recently in the Cinquanelli case. Let me end with talking about what I think are some unintended consequences of particularly House Bill 2648, and you heard the very interesting prior testimony from the Health Division with regard to the definition of manufacturer. And the part that is particularly interesting is that on line 24 of the bill, or an entity engaged in the packaging, repackaging, labeling, or distribution of prescription drugs. And then pharmacists are definitionally excluded. Entities that distribute drugs other than pharmacists include, without attempting to provide an exhaustive list, safety net clinics which obtain drugs pursuant to the compassionate care programs, the patient assistance programs that our companies provide to well in excess of 50,000 Oregonians a year, and physicians who provide typically the first batch of free drugs under one of the prescription assistance programs, because they, quote, distribute, and they're not excluded in the way that pharmacists are. So, I'm sure that was an unintended consequence, but I think it's for the same reasons the Health Division was mentioning, that probably falls within the scope of the bill. Let me stop there.
Let me ask about that. Do you have a better definition of what a pharmaceutical manufacturing company is?
Mr. Chair, I don't at hand. Somebody may, though, but I don't have it. I don't have it at hand.
Okay.
I have several questions. But go ahead.
I was wondering whether you want to get Tom first.
No, I'd rather. Well,
go for it.
My mind is still sort of fresh here. Thank you, Mr. Gardner, for joining us. Mr. Gardner, how many pharmaceutical companies are there?
Boy, Madam Chair, I don't know the answer to that. I can get that for you, I do know it is a fairly dispersed market. If you compare it to some other industries, market shares typically, for the big ones, hover around 5 to 7%.
I'm confused.
Market shares for the larger ones are in the range of 5 to 7% of the market.
That still is not telling me how many pharmaceutical companies.
I don't know the answer to that.
Okay, if you could find out.
Yep,
do you have a ballpark figure? Are there 5? Are there 500? Are there 5,000?
Madam Chair, I know it's less than 5,000, and I think the answer will vary depending on whether you toss in the generic companies. But I'll get an answer to that.
For both those generic companies?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, and how many does pharma represent?
The total membership, Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, I believe is in the range of about 100, but I will double check that as well.
Thank you. So I'm going to keep on.
Keep going. Yeah.
Great. So you mentioned the voluntary codes for those who were involved in members of pharma. So I'm assuming those voluntary codes only apply to members of PhRMA. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that's incorrect, because the OIG essentially incorporates, it's not a mandate, but it's...
And OIG is
or Office of Inspector General of HHS. It incorporates a very strong recommendation in its enforcement regime, a recommendation that you have a voluntary code if you are...
Recommendation, and it's voluntary, is that correct?
Well, Madam Chair, it's voluntary in the sense that if you want to avoid getting stuck with criminal penalties or exclusion from Medicaid and Medicare, it behooves you to have it. So I don't know how voluntary that really is in, as a matter of fact. To my knowledge, every one of the companies that I'm familiar with has one of these in part to be in complete compliance and in the good graces of OIG.
Okay. Oh, now I've lost sort of, but you mentioned market strategy. So it's clear that what you're saying is that that gifting to people to healthcare professionals is a marketing strategy. Am I correct in saying that?
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, I think that the biggest component of marketing dollars are free samples. I think that I would have to agree that the activities that Representative Maurer was describing certainly do constitute marketing activities.
So if I can stop you there, so I'm just trying to get it clear in my mind. So, oh, I remember now, you had said something that would be unfair practice if it was made public, the marketing strategies. So the pharmaceutical companies that you represent, which are maybe 100, which would be actually a small proportion of all the pharmaceutical companies. Am I correct in
that? No, Madam Chair, I don't think you're correct in that. If you're measuring by market share.
No, I'm not measuring by market share. I'm talking about the number of pharmaceutical companies.
Madam Chair, I'd have to check that.
Okay, thank you. Have I lost my train of thought? So... the implication is that if you make that public, then you are sharing the market strategy of the pharmaceutical company who is giving free samples or is giving lectures or whatever it's doing. That is a market strategy, correct?
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, that's it is in part a marketing strategy, but the marketing disclosure would go, I think, well beyond that to include things like discounts and price arrangements, which...
But that's not what we're talking about here.
I think the bill speaks to anything of value, so I think that is precisely what you're talking about here.
Okay.
I don't understand what you just said, Jim.
Mr. Chair, Bill, I believe, speaks in terms of items of value.
Or other economic benefits.
Yes.
That's line 7 of Bill 2523, is what you're referring to.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, please.
Thank you. Hi, Mr. Gardner. I was looking at this whole discussion around marketing costs and free drugs. I was just wondering if you thought there would be a competitive advantage for companies to reveal to the public that they are good stewards and are actually providing a good deal of free drugs and actually quantifying that, and they could be held up as a good partner in the community and might actually be a competitive advantage to show that publicly. I'm just wondering what you think about that.
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, Representative Kotek, I really... I'm not enough of a marketing guru to kind of speculate on that. I will tell you that the companies I have seen have been very proud and very aggressive about making available information to low-income Oregonians, information about their compassionate care programs, their patient assistance programs. I would like to think that that was motivated by purely altruistic motives, but I can certainly see that there might be some perception of a corporate advantage that would be in line with your question.
Thank you. Second question? Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. On the anti-competitive and anti-free market argument that you're making, you say that no other business entity in Oregon must disclose their marketing costs. I'm of the opinion that healthcare is a community good, and so it to some degrees rises to a different standard in terms of transparency around the marketing issue. I'm just wondering your thoughts on that and how that applies in Oregon.
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, Representative Kotek, I think to some degree special rules do apply because of Medicaid and Medicare funding in particular, because of the public funds that are expended out of the general fund as well. And for that reason, we have in place that enforcement regime that I mentioned before that's policed by HHS. It's essentially an anti-kickback, anti-rebate regime. So I would, to a degree, I would agree with you, but I think that the question is it appropriate to single out one participant in that industry, in that sector, when we are, and the statistics I have, and I'll try to get a Kaiser Family Foundation sheet on this to you, the statistics I have, it is that it's roughly hovers around 12% of the healthcare dollar, the RX share.
I'm sorry, is marketing cost?
No. That's the total share of the healthcare dollar attributable to prescription drugs. That's the figure I have. I'll try to get you some documentation from the Kaiser Family Foundation on that. But I guess the sort of broader answer to your question is, to a degree, I think that's correct. That there is it's appropriate to have special rules apply to the healthcare sector because there is such heavy involvement in terms of public funding. And those rules do exist through OIG, and this bill, it seems to us, really does single out one segment of the healthcare industry for special treatment above and beyond others.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Gardner, for being here. I have a question about your trade secret argument in here about trade secrets are legally protected property, but under, and I'm talking about 2523, the disclosures to the Department of Justice, and Section 4 specifically says that the Department of Justice shall keep confidential all information reported under the section that qualifies as a trade secret. So I'm struggling to understand why you're saying that it would constitute a violation of federal trade secret law.
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, Representative Bonamici, and I'm not, believe me, an expert in this area, but what I believe is that the federal law that is referenced there, the 42 U.S. Code, permits disclosure of confidential information regarding pricing strategies and rebates that's required to be disclosed to HHS, and it is shared with State Department of Human Services administrators, but I believe that's as far as it's allowed to go. So I think that's the technical reason that that there could be a, even if the Department of Justice is watertight, I believe the restriction, and I'll correct myself if I'm wrong on this quickly after I've checked with the lawyers, but I believe it restricts the dissemination of information like that, pricing strategy information, to the Department of Human Services.
I'd be very interested in knowing about that. And follow up, please, Mr. Chair?
Absolutely.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm also interested in light of that, in your contention that there's a federal law that would prohibit that. How is this working in Vermont where it's already under?
I'm not familiar with that. I will check that as well.
Thank you.
Representative Bauer?
Madam Chair, there's two questions here. One is about the exclusion for payment of reasonable compensation reimbursement of expenses for bona fide clinical trials. And how would you define bona fide? How do you define reasonable? Because I think the general public's perception of reasonable may not be the same as a physician's definition of reasonable. And I guess a concern in all of this is you build ways to game the system, and how do you look at that particular clause?
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, Representative Maurer, we're not going to know what those terms, they're not defined in the statute, we're not going to know what those terms mean until and unless there's a court case that goes to the Oregon Supreme Court. Okay. I don't know what they mean.
Thank you. And the other issue, follow up, Madam Chair, is I don't think it was clear about the issue of the Office of Inspector General and their voluntary program to develop these compliance programs and what that means. It may be voluntary, but they put your arm around you and say, you know, it's voluntary, but if you don't, we're going to pull the money away from you. And is that an accurate analogy or explanation?
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, Representative Maurer, that's exactly correct. And I didn't state it with the succinctness and eloquence that you just did, but that's exactly correct. And I believe Mr. Holt is going to be addressing the issue of OIG enforcement at greater length and with specific reference to his own company's experience.
Any further questions at this point?
I have some.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you. First, your cautionary tale reminded me of what we teach primary care residents, and that's the four rules of medicine. If what you're doing is working, keep doing it. If what you're doing isn't working, stop doing it. If you don't know what to do, don't do anything, and never call a surgeon. I am interested in what the market share of the pharma companies are. Could you?
I will. Yes, Mr. Chairman.
The main question I have is if you talk about, I'll ask Tom the same thing, you talk about there now being corporate policies on gifting that each corporation or most corporations have as a result of the OIG coercion, and the statement inside Pharma's bill, if 2648 could be crafted so it fit inside all of those or the majority of those companies' current ban on gifting, would pharma and those companies stand aside in objection to that bill?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we, of course, evaluate individually each amendment and each iteration of legislation. I certainly have received no indication that this particular ban bill could be crafted in an acceptable way, in part because of the Article 1, Section 8 issue, which is, I think, a very difficult issue, a very difficult issue to address.
They simply exclude informational material.
Well, the question becomes, under the Oregon Supreme Court's, you know, expansive interpretation of Article 1, Section 8, just what does that include and what does it exclude? Now, I can share some information with the committee in writing about that, if you like. But I guess again, going back to my precautionary principle, the question would be, if you became satisfied that because of a combination of the OIG rules and the compliance codes, that the problem that you perceived perhaps 2 or 3 years ago simply doesn't exist now, I guess I would ask, what's the rationale for a bill?
Well, I would say I would perceive it's solved at the corporate policy level, but I'm not convinced it's solved on the ground.
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I again, without a without the kind of hands-on experience that I have heard accounts of from many practitioners, many healthcare clinics, I would submit that it's likely that the experience recounted by Representative Maurer is fairly typical.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mr. Gardner, before we let you go, I am not a lawyer, and I think you are. Am I correct that you're a trained lawyer?
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, yes.
Thank you. And I'm not a healthcare professional like our good Chair Greenlick is. And I know you're not only an attorney, but you were in the legislature, is that correct?
Yes, Madam Chair.
And you are also a lobbyist, is that correct?
That's correct.
So in my brain, it's hard for me to understand what the problem is with this disclosure and transparency. As a legislator, you had to be open and transparent, ethical, and as a lobbyist, you're required to do the same thing. It's hard for me to understand why the pharmaceutical company is so opposed to being transparent, to disclosure. So maybe you can help me with that.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, without, you know, repeating ad nauseum all of my prior testimony, which I know you don't want to hear, I think there is a concern that, number one, this industry is being singled out in this bill, and number two, that the perceived problem, which is, I think, properly characterized as inappropriate gifting, the perceived problem has been addressed and, from every bit of evidence I have, has been solved. And that...
if we disagreed on that, so it might be the perception of some of us that that problem has not been solved. And we take your word and we take the word of Representative Maurer that perhaps it is solved, but perhaps it is not. So I'm assuming that when someone gifts takes a physician out to dinner or provides a lunch for all the healthcare professionals in a health clinic or whatever it might be, whatever the benefit might be to the healthcare professionals, that they need to report that to their bosses, to the owner of that pharmaceutical company. So that needs to be reported to someone. So what would be the huge problem in reporting it also to the, isn't it the Attorney General's office that this would go to? Mm-hmm. To whom does it go, do you remember?
No.
It goes to the Department of Justice.
Department of Justice, correct. So it would be a click on the computer.
Well,
am I correct?
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, let me just, again, without going through my testimony with regard to the federal rebate confidentiality law, point out one potential problem, and that has to do, because the definition doesn't just include a dinner or a drink or tickets to a ball game. It's other things of economic value, which would include discounts and rebates. If you have a situation where pricing information is inappropriately shared, I would argue that you could facilitate and discourage some of the aggressive discounting that does occur now in a very competitive environment. It's a little bit like the situation with prime rates, you know. Gee, it's some kind of a funny coincidence that they all tend to kind of be the same. And it's called, in antitrust law, it's called conscious parallelism. I'm not certain that kind of registering of pricing information, which would be included in the economic benefit portion of this bill, I'm not sure that always promotes the most aggressive price competition. Now, I will tell you that many economists would argue exactly the opposite, that in fact, you know, transparency, price competition is the best way to ensure the lowest price and drive competition, and there's an argument to be made for that. But there is a another point of view that says you can encourage by disclosing, requiring the disclosure of all the discounts that are paid, you can encourage the practice of conscious parallelism.
Of course, that is not the intent of this bill, and you've lost me, so we will stop
there. I apologize, Madam Chair.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Yes, Madam Chair.
Hi. Okay, I think we need to move on.
I'll just make it.
Need to be done at noon.
I'll just make a quick comment. I feel the need to respond to the singling out issue, because we could argue too that legislators are singled out as having to make a disclosure, and so that's a policy decision that we make as legislators. And so saying we can't single out a particular industry, I think, is sort of contrary to why we're here. I mean, we've singled out legislators as people who need to disclose. So I felt the need.
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair. Representative Bonamici, I believe that the ethics prohibitions against gifts over a certain size, I believe those apply to all public officials, not simply legislators. Mayors and, you know, I believe that's the case.
Mr. Holt.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Tom Holt. I'm with Shearing Plough Corporation. We are a research-based pharmaceutical manufacturer. We're in the business of developing and marketing products that improve people's lives and save lives. I'm here today to give you a little bit more detail about the degree to which we actually are already regulated very tightly in this area, not in what we would regard as a voluntary manner. There is underlying all of this discussion something that hasn't been talked about. Is there's a federal anti-kickback statute that applies to Medicaid and Medicare, which makes it, in just about every state has a state statute that mirrors that federal law, and it makes it both a criminal and a civil offense to knowingly and willingly offer, pay, solicit, or receive any remuneration to induce someone or to refer an item, that could be a prescription drug prescribing, or reward someone for doing that. The Office of Inspector General, the Department of Health and Human Services, is sort of the enforcer of that, and I've provided to you basically the job description of the Office of Inspector General. And I would just point you to, I highlighted on page 3, in the bottom middle, there's a paragraph there that basically says, in a nutshell, that the General Counsel of the Office of Inspector General, if they think we have done wrong, can throw us out of not just Medicare and Medicaid, veterans programs, federal employee benefit programs, every piece of business with the federal government, which is quite large in total. So it's not something that we care to mess with. As Jim alluded to, the Office of Inspector General adopted, quote-unquote, guidelines, which in our view have the force of regulation, following the pharma guidelines, but go much further. They require us to have a separate compliance program, a separate department, totally apart from all other aspects of the company. We're required to have a compliance officer. We're required to have a hotline. In our company, we call it the Integrity Action Line. If someone sees something that's not right going on, you're supposed to pick up the phone and you call and you report it.
That'd be scary.
Penalty for violating our internal policies is very simple. It's dismissal, ultimately. And the words we have for people who violate the policy are, you're fired. It's really that seriously taken. Now, because the OIG has so much sway over really every aspect of the way that we do business, if it touches federal funds, we and other companies often go to them for guidance on very specific things. In our case, I've also provided to you a copy of the letter that we got from the OIG back just this last fall, after the institution of the Medicare Part D program. We wanted to be able to continue our patient assistance program to provide free drugs to people who are needy through the so-called donut hole, and work with and around the Part D program and be able to continue that. But under the kickback statute, if you give something of value to someone and it could be read to induce them to prescribe that drug or use that drug, you're in trouble. So we wanted to get guidance from the OIG, well, if we provide a free product to someone in need, is that inducing them under the kickback statute? We needed to have an answer to that before we could continue our program. And the answer we got back, fortunately, and it's all detailed in the letter, is, well, yes, you can, and here's how you do it. And subsequent to that, the Office of Inspector General issued guidelines to the entire industry of how to go about doing a patient assistance program in the Part D world. And I can only speak for my company, but certainly our program, and I would suspect every other program now, follows those quote-unquote voluntary guidelines. They are you know, voluntary only to the extent that you wish to risk severe penalties for not following them. So you know, that's really all I had to say today. I wanted to just be able to give you a very specific example of the power that the OIG already has over us in this area. We don't see these bills as addressing a problem that any longer exists in the industry. We have extensive internal policies enforced by the federal government to deal with any problems that may occur. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Holt. Any questions? Representative.
Thank you. I'm not sure. Mr. Holt, you talked about the power of these suggestions. And are there any companies that you're aware of where they have crossed the line and there have been actions taken against them?
Chair Greenlick, Chair Tomei, Representative Richardson, yes, our company several years ago. And we operate under a consent agreement for those things. We made a number of corrections, among them replacing most of our management.
Follow up?
Yeah, Representative Kodak.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for your testimony. I was wondering if what the industry sense or your company sense of why these regulations were put into place, and if they are that important, why not do whatever we can to expand them to make sure that outside the publicly funded programs we're not seeing abuses?
Mm-hmm. Chair Greenlick, Chair Tomei, Representative Potek, I appreciate the question. I don't think there's any question that there were abuses in the past. To a large degree, that's why we as an industry adopted guidelines and why we now have fairly detailed regimes internally in each of our companies to deal with these issues. But those things don't happen anymore. We have very specific policies within our company of what people can and cannot do. I can't get into all the detail of our policy is proprietary in public hearing, but I can assure you that the guidelines are quite strict.
Quick follow-up?
Follow-up.
And I appreciate that there was a sense of self-policing in the industry. But we all know that companies change, people change. One of the reason we put things in the statute is to make sure for perpetuity these things continue. And so I think that's part of what we're trying to achieve today, even if some of this problem has been solved to a certain degree. Voluntariness doesn't necessarily keep it from happening again.
Chair Greenlick, Chair Tomei, is that
I don't know. That's just a question. That's just a comment. Thank you for indulging me.
Representative Kennedy, did you have a question?
I did. Thank you, Madam Chair. I know I would find it very helpful if you could direct us either now, because it's here in front of us and I haven't found it, or through a subsequent provision of information, where in the Federal Register or federal statute the guidelines related to kickbacks, incentives, et cetera, are presented. We have some copies here, and I've been thumbing through them, and I see some of the, you've highlighted some of the enforcement provision, but I haven't been able to find the actual, where it's actually spelled out what you're subject to or risk exclusion from the federal programs.
Chair Tomei, Chair Greenlick, and Representative Canada, I'm delighted to provide that to you. Can provide you a copy of the anti-kickback statute that's relevant. And there's also an extensive document on the OIG's website that lays out all the elements that have to be within a corporate compliance program and what's required of us by the OIG, if that's responsive to what your need is.
It is, and follow-up?
Follow-up.
I guess I would recommend or suggest to the committee as well as to you that if we were to pursue legislation, or Oregon legislation, it might be wise to do it consistently with what the federal government is also doing. And I guess I am interested in your response. If we developed statutory language that was just entirely consistent with the regime that you're already under federal guidelines required to follow, what would you think?
Chair Tomei, Chair Greenlick, Representative Cannon, I think my answer to that question would be the same as Mr. Gardner's earlier, in that we'd have to see the language. Obviously, I would have to take that back to my company for examination.
Thank you.
Representative Flyer. Thank you, Madam Chair, Mr. Chair. First, in response to Representative Kotek's statement that we would want to put something like this in statute in perpetuity, I would add, or until the legislature meets again. However, I do have a question that might be able to provide the information back to us at some point, and that is in reference to Representative Tomei's presentation. And the statement that's made that 90% of the pharmaceutical industry's budget of $21 million annually is marketing budget, and 90% of that is on gifts and promotion. Can you give us some context for that in writing that we might be able to make the comparison, or to source that for us? Because I recall that Representative Maurer asked for a source, and we didn't have that information. So if we could have that information, that would be helpful.
And whatever information you provide, please give it to our professional staff so they can distribute to all of us. Thank you.
Both committees.
Thank you. Follow-up?
Follow-up.
Thank you. What, in the provision of gifts that might be underway at this point in time, can anything be provided to doctors or offices or whatever that do not relate to the healthcare industry?
Chair Tomei, Representative
Flores. I go golfing. Yeah.
And Representative Flores. No. It has to be, anything provided has to be related to the practice. For instance, a medical reference, a reprint of a study, a peer-reviewed study, those sorts of things. Our reps cannot take people to play golf. They can't send them to Maui. Things of that nature.
Follow-up. Thank you, Madam Chair. So if those were the types of gifts that were in fact provided, would the penalties for that be, other than you're fired, be in the information that you're going to provide Representative Cannon on the statutory penalties? Is that what I'm understanding?
Yes.
Thank you. And one final follow-up.
Follow-up.
Thank you. Representative Bonamici brought up something earlier that was in regard to the Vermont legislation, and that just kind of triggered a reaction in me, in that yesterday in our committee we heard about Vermont initiatives that apparently are sweeping the country, and I think that they were promulgated by Consumers Union or something like that. Can you give us information, or do you have knowledge about this particular effort in pharmaceutical and healthcare industry regulation?
Chair Tomei, Chair Greenlick, Representative Flores, I am aware that there are some very recent pieces of legislation in some of the northeastern states. I think Vermont is the state. But I am not familiar with all the details. Would be, you know, happy to provide you with whatever I can find on it.
Thank you. Or whoever might have that available for us, I think might be interesting.
And I would like to ask that of both you gentlemen, if you could let us know how the laws in Vermont have affected your company. And thank you so much. We're going to have to move along. Thank you very much. And I think the only other person who has signed up is Laura Etherton. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify?
I think we're not going to have time for the testimony. We have both. When we finish this, we need to stand at ease for a moment and then regroup with the Health Care Committee. We have two bills I'd like to pass out today that have come to us from the subcommittee.
Okay. Ms. Atherton.
Hi there. thank you, Chair Greenlick and Chair Tomei, for the opportunity to testify here today, members of the committee. My name is Laura Etherton. For the record, I'm a consumer advocate with Oregon State Public Interest Research Group, or OSPIRG. House Bills 2523 and 2648 both take steps forward to address the use of gifts, payments, trips, and other enticements used by the pharmaceutical sales representatives in their marketing to doctors to promote specific medications. The skyrocketing costs of prescription drugs are a problem for Oregonians. They drive up the overall cost of health care and put important medicine out of reach for too many. At the same time, there are concerns about ensuring the adequate safety of prescription drugs to protect the public interest, with relatively recent instances that are troubling with drug makers heavily marketing pharmaceuticals despite evidence of their adverse health effects. Vioxx is an example that comes to mind, the painkiller that had significant threats regarding heart problems. As part of the overall effort to address these problems, many are taking a closer look at the role that promotional practices of pharmaceutical drug companies have, in particular the practice of the drug detailing, the practice where sales reps meet one-on-one with doctors to promote specific brand-name drugs. Sales representatives have significant access to doctors' prescribing histories and habits, and as part of the meetings have, over the years of this practice, commonly brought gifts along to those meetings, whether they are the small types of gifts that we're probably all familiar with, the notepads and the pens, or whether they're more significant meals or paying for a doctor or other representative to go to a conference and speak to other doctors about the relative merits of various pharmaceutical products. The concern about these gifts and other spending are not only that they are inappropriate, but that they encourage more prescriptions of the newest and most expensive and sometimes unproven prescription drugs, when equally effective drugs that are cheaper may be more effective and more appropriate and at times safer for the patient. I've heard quite a bit about the a number of voluntary guidelines that have been established, and that's definitely a step in the right direction. The American Medical Association also has adopted a set of guidelines and updated those, determining appropriate limits for gifts and other industry-supported programs. The pharma has adopted a set of guidelines as well, and as you've heard, the OIG has done that as well. I wanted to point out that the AMA and pharma guidelines are voluntary, and they lack adequate enforcement mechanisms. The OIG guidance it's essential to safeguarding the integrity of the federal healthcare programs, but that is narrow in scope and does just relate to to those federal programs and not to the interactions with providers when they do not relate to those federal healthcare programs. And so, in order to have adequate enforcement to protect the public, and I think to make sure that all of the interactions, the daily interactions between drug representatives and physicians, are sort of captured in this transparency effort, that enacting limits and additional disclosure regarding the use of gifts in this area is appropriate. It will not only reduce the appearance of impropriety, which I think damages what patients' perception of their physicians, and I think Oregon has some of the best physicians, and that relationship really is important. But also that decreasing increasing the amount of scrutiny given to this area may have the beneficial effect, as it's I think trending toward, to reduce these types of gifts, which will both free up money to be used for more research or to reduce the actual cost of pharmaceuticals for consumers. So we support both of these bills to ban gifts and to add disclosure, and are interested in discussion about whether that approach or whether codifying some of these currently voluntary guidelines are the right approach. Inclination is that the more strict bans on gifts and really clear disclosure are the most appropriate and most protective of the public. Thank you.
Any quick questions of Ms. Etherton? Representative Rubin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I just want to probe your testimony one specific point, because it's been a point that's been brought out since we first started today, and it's a point that I don't think has been challenged, and it's the point or the question, if you will. Our assumption that these marketing dollars being spent drive up the costs of prescription drugs. Can you tell me why that is? And I'll tell you why I'm asking the question. Hopefully it doesn't sound like a foolish question. I don't know a single company that ever markets to keep their sales static or below. And, of course, if that were the result of marketing, then, yes, those marketing costs, those sales costs, would add to the net unit cost. But if the goal here of marketing for pharmaceutical companies or any company is to increase sales, you're potentially lowering costs through economies of scale. So can we play out the assumption here that we're all sort of using and haven't challenged yet, in that marketing leads to increased costs?
Absolutely, Mr. Chair and Madam Chair and Representative Bruin. You're right. The marketing has two impacts. One is to and this is both true for the marketing to doctors and direct marketing to consumers, which is to drive up the overall usage of prescription drugs, the overall volume, and the awareness, whether for that consumer or that doctor, of one brand versus another. And that's one area. The purpose specifically of pharmaceutical detailing is to increase not only the prescription writing for that brand, it's to increase the prescription writing for that brand, particularly in that brand over their competitors' brands, but also over generic drugs. And that's really where the increase often comes into play, that the marketing is very effective at increasing the prescription writing for those brand name drugs, even when a generic drug that has a more tested safety record and is less expensive may actually be the safer and more effective treatment for that patient.
And in fact, it may even be a drug manufactured by the same company. The theory behind this is that the main purpose is to drive prescribing to more expensive and sometimes less effective drugs rather than other drugs that are on the market. And there are just so many instances of that. That's very
clear. Just real quick. I know we're time pressed. If we're too time pressed, I'll hold off. So.
I just have one thing. Ms. Etherton, you mentioned something that has been brought to my attention before and I hadn't thought about recently, and it's in 1, 2, 3. The third paragraph, you mentioned detailing, and there are only over 87,000 drug detailers. And in the next paragraph, you say something that is very concerning to me about the drug companies buy the prescription histories of individual physicians and then precise information which classes, forms, and dosages of drugs each physician prescribes, and then use direct marketing to those. Can you give us, we don't have the time now, Representative Merkley,
I just got promoted.
The speaker.
Greenlick is getting antsy, and I know he wants to move on. So if you could give the whole committee more information about that, I think that would be very interesting for us to have.
Madam Chair, I'd be happy to do that.
Thank you so much for coming to testify.
Before you
have
one comment, having been through this whole meeting today, I'm concerned about one thing. We've drawn the analogy with the legislature, but if the analogy was going to hold, we'd be saying we will be fining lobbyists $10,000 if they give a gift to the legislature, which we don't do. What we're really saying is the legislature, because of our rules, are not allowed to receive gifts. The federal government does not say we're going to fine the companies for exercising their commerce clause and their rights to do business by marketing their products. They merely say, we will not allow you to receive compensation from federal government, which is like 40% of their business, which is a pretty heavy club. If these bills were saying, if the pharmaceutical companies provide gifts to doctors in the state of Oregon, we will withhold DHS's business from them, then the analogy would hold true. But what we're really saying is the doctors are unable to resist this kind of pressure, and to protect the doctors from that overwhelming pressure, we're going to tell the pharmaceutical companies,
Now, we're going to charge you a fine of $10,000 for exercising your right to market these products because we've got to protect the doctors. If the analogy was going to hold true, we would be saying to the doctors, for you to be licensed in the state of Oregon, then you will not receive those kinds of gifts if they're offered to you, or else your license would be in jeopardy, just like as legislators we'd be in jeopardy. And so I think that, you know, I'm not a constitutional attorney, but I think that I'd be asking LC, are you sure that we can put a civil fine on companies who are exercising their rights to try and do business because we don't like the way that they might be giving gifts to somebody who might be receiving a gift? I just, as I see this, I think that we may be approaching it in a unique way, and I just wanted to clarify that.
Are you going
to
get that amendment ready? Barring them from doing business with the state of Oregon?
Let me quickly check and see.
That would be more than the $10,000.
Well, certainly, but see, you would get the same result that it is being attempted. I'm just bringing that up.
We do need to move on.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, one last quick thing. I referenced the FDA white paper regarding generic prices in the United States, and I have a copy for that for everybody on the committee.
Great. And we also forgot to mention that AARP also provided a statement for us, which I want to make sure.
Madam Chair, what are the next steps on this bill?
The co-chairs have not discussed that yet.
We'll see.
So I'll close the hearing. Public hearing on House Bills 2648 and 2523, and close the Health and Human the Human Services and Women's Wellness Committee.
And we'll stand at ease for a moment while our
we are.
On House Bill 2242, who's carrying that bill?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative Bruin is carrying the bill,
okay.
And we have some meetings.
You're carrying both bills?
Yes, he is.
Okay. Good work today.
Okay. Are we ready?
I do have meeting packets for everybody.
Good. Let's pass them out.
For the work session. Can you take? Actually, I just split that one in. Sorry. Okay, this is a work session packet because the LCs are in there, too.
Thank you.
Thank you. But you took it out of order, right?
So I took it out of order. 2242 first. Sandy, will you retell us what 2242 is, and then we'll get...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2242 was at the request of... I need to breathe. The Oregon Board of Chiropractic Examiners, the subcommittee, your health care subcommittee on health policy had a public hearing on January 23rd, on February 8th, with a work session on the 8th. It does several things, housekeeping type measures. It changes the definition of limited active to an active senior. There was some confusion around that. It expands the board authority in license denials relating to moral turpitude. It outlines and it allows chiropractic physicians to use oxygen in an emergency, as the FDA has made some revisions, which now allows them to do that. It modifies their current license renewal notice from 60 days to 30 days. And it changes the current requirement for a board member to have 1 year of practice to a minimum of 5 years. And there are other changes, and I believe the carrier will also repeat and expand on a few other things. There is no fiscal or revenue impact on this bill.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I bring to you House Bill 2242, which was passed unanimously with a due pass recommendation from your health care subcommittee on health policy. The points that I have and would articulate are the points that Sandy just eloquently stated. Would you like me to repeat them, or have you heard enough to...
I'll accept the motion.
Do I need to do that?
You may.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2242 to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
We have a motion on the floor. Is there any discussion?
If we wanted to put this on the consent calendar.
I think we will.
Do that after. Okay.
Yep. Okay. Any objections? Well, pass. The motion carries. And we will put it on the consent calendar.
Oh,
we need a motion for the consent calendar.
Yes, we do. Do I have a motion?
Mr. Chair, I move that we move House Bill 2242 to the consent. The consent, help me out here.
Consent calendar,
thank you.
Any objection to that motion? We'll move to, what's the number? 2242 to the consent calendar. Move to the floor with a due pass recommendation on the consent calendar. We'll close the work session on 2242. And we'll open a work session on... Yes.
Do you want your name to carry on?
No, it's in the consent calendar.
I'm sorry. Right. You know what?
Right. We'll figure this one out. I'll figure it out. Let's open a work session on 2188A, and I believe we have the same person carrying it to us, right?
Yes. Correct.
And he's prepared to speak for this one. Solo.
Thank you.
You let him do it. Okay.
If he wishes.
Mr. Chair, I bring House Bill 21. Somebody brings House Bill 2188, which was passed unanimously. New pass recommendation once again from your healthcare, your House committee, your healthcare subcommittee on health policy. What this does is basically expand the current Oregon alert system. The Oregon alert system, as you know, is the statewide clearinghouse for immunization registration and information that that catalogs children in the state of Oregon's immunization records, and that information is available to schools and to medical providers and other areas or other points of interest. What House Bill 2188 does is expand the definition of authorized users to include parents or guardians of children under 18 years of age, clients 18 years of age or older, post-secondary educational institutions for the purpose of sharing immunization records through immunization registries. Also adds the requirement that if requested by the client who is 18 or older, the immunization information may be removed from the registry. We had extensive and excellent testimony on this bill. All aspects of this bill had no there were no questions at all, other than potentially the protection of the information and how we would adjudicate that, or if it was adjudicated. And so one of the issues that came up, Mr. Chair, was does Oregon law currently have enough teeth in it to prevent unwarranted dispersal of private healthcare or private client information? After talking about it for a long time, the general sense of the committee was it probably does, but we had a couple of concerns, and we voiced those concerns with the agency. The agency has come back and has provided some information to us, which includes expansion of their authorized user agreement to include specifically the HIPAA requirements and the HIPAA issues related to any violation. And I should say they've never had a violation, but would sort of clarify if there ever were any violations of that competency. So, there you have it.
Have a motion?
If I'm allowed, I move that we pass House Bill 2188 to the House floor with a due pass.
2188A.
2188A to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
And the A comes about because there's two words deleted. I think you had that amendment.
That's right.
Any discussion?
Mr. Chair, I just want to thank the department for coming fast around on the authorization form. That was great. Thank you.
And I want to thank Representative Bruin for working this issue, so we all have a little confidence in it now. Any other discussion?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, ma'am.
Members of the committee may notice I just passed out a fiscal statement. It's just to bring to your attention. They are not attaching a dollar amount, but they are providing some explanation on the dynamics of any potential funding as the bill moves forward through their phases. So, this bill does not have a referral to Ways and Means or right. anything thereof, but I just wanted to highlight that for your record.
Thank you. A non-fiscal.
Exactly.
An almost non-fiscal.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Okay. The clerk will call the roll.
Representative Bonamici.
Aye.
Representative
Representative Bruin.
Aye.
Representative
Cannon.
Aye.
Representative
Flores.
Aye.
Representative
Duncan.
Aye.
Representative
Nauer.
Aye.
Vice Chair Kotek.
Aye.
Vice Chair
Richardson.
Aye.
Chair Greenland.
Aye. And would you be willing to be the
carrier
on this? I would. Good. Thank you very much. We have one more piece of business. We have before us an LC. I had it before us. Before me, unless it disappeared. No? Okay. We have before us LC 2681, for which it's been requested that it be introduced as a committee bill. For the newer members, introducing a bill as a committee bill doesn't endorse it or anything else. It's just a process that gets it in. And in fact, in the past, I've tried to get my fingerprints off a bill by introducing it as a committee bill with the hope it'll move to a certain committee, and that didn't happen. It can move to any committee. So we may introduce it as a committee bill, and it may end up wherever it ends up. So the process is just to get it into the process. And I would accept a motion to introduce 2681, LC 2681 as a committee bill.
Mr. Chair, I move LC draft 2681 be introduced as a committee bill.
Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? LC 2681 will be introduced as a committee bill. Is there any other discussion? I close the meeting of the House Committee on Health Care, and I remind you all that we will not have a 3 o'clock meeting today. On Monday, we are going to have a subcommittee meeting on HJR 18. Is that right? Yeah, HJR 18, as well as a response from the health insurance industry to DCBS's health insurance report. And we'll have four health insurance executives talking to us about their reaction. It should be very interesting, and we'll have the first public hearing on HJR 18. We might have, and I'll just alert you, we might have our full committee meeting next week on Wednesday from 3 to 5. I hope if we do, we'll know by very soon. I hope it doesn't cause any severe problems.
Representative Greenman?
Yes, ma'am.
When there are meetings, it's just a request that are going to be held on days that some of us don't normally meet. It would help to have further advance warning because of commitments that are made outside of the building.
We'll try very hard.
That can't be changed, and I apologize that I will not be able to join you next Wednesday.
I understand that's a possibility, and we might not meet on Wednesday. It depends. There is some leadership, possible leadership interest in moving HJR 18 to a possible May election, and so we need to move very quickly on it. But it'll be up to leadership to tell us, and it depends not on this at all, but on a bunch of other things that are going on. So we will know by Monday whether that's going to be leadership's interest to do that.
Mr. Chair, the Monday meeting, are you calling the full
Monday meeting is a subcommittee meeting.
Okay.
It is the regularly scheduled subcommittee on access, although any of you are always welcome. You're all always welcome to go to either subcommittee meetings, and it's really nice if you do that.
Thank you.
We're adjourned.